Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM in the East Bay and on the web at berkeleyliberationradio.net. This is Radio Autonomia, Autonomy Radio Zapatismo in the Bay. Our collective media project takes inspiration from the Zapatista movement in Chiapas, Mexico, and focuses on autonomous political, economic, and social projects in the Bay Area that resonate with anti-capitalist rebel spirit of Zapatismo. We're here the first Sunday of every month from 4 to 6 p.m. To listen to and download past Radio Autonomia segments and shows, visit our website at radioautonomia.wordpress.com. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or you want to get involved, shoot us a message as radioautonomia@gmail.com.
For today's show, we wanted to present a conversation around two themes, community regeneration and self-determination. We define community regeneration as the acts or practices that heal and empower communities to restore their dignity and build resiliency. We define self-determination as practices of communities that look and learn from themselves, rather than the state, to articulate their own needs, desires, solutions, and answers. We situate this conversation of resistance within capitalism's ability to isolate and destroy individuals and communities through two major forces, the predatory lending or debt institutions and the prison industrial complex.
We situate this conversation of resistance. In the first part of our show, we look at the notion of debt and how it keeps us isolated and ashamed. What if we began to reframe the conversation of debt without the state being the one we owe or are obligated to? What if we were in debt or obligated to our neighbors or community members? How do we build relationships of obligation and trust? In the first part of our show, we talk to Strike Debt, a national coalition built out of the Occupy movement that looks to build a popular resistance to all forms of debt imposed on us by predatory lending institutions.
In the second part of our show, we explore how the prison industrial complex isolates and criminalizes individuals both on the outside and inside of the prison walls. We look to three community organizers from All of Us or None in the Prison Hunger Solidarity Coalition, the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and the Oakland Community Medics to share analysis of and shed light to the effects of the prison industrial complex in communities of color and low-income communities. We hope to then share strategies from communities that are finding new ways to restore dignity through solidarity with those on the inside. We see these conversations as, one, a challenge to reformist approaches that reinforce symbolic and physical violence in our communities, and two, rejecting the isolating effects of capital by creating spaces of community convergence to support each other. But before all that, let's go to a musical break.
Are you ready to begin?
Thank you.
Radio Autonomía, on Berkeley Liberation Radio. In the studio today, we have DJ Pulga, DJ Profe, and DJ Kayla, and we also have the folks from Strike Depth. So we have JP and Margaret, who will be sharing what Strike Debt is, and it's a nationwide initiative. It's an offshoot of the Occupy movement. And I'm going to read a little bit from their website, the website's principles page, to set the framework of this project. And if you're interested in going on their website, it's strike-debt.bay.area.tumblr.com. Is there an easier way? No, okay.
Just Google
Strike Debt Bay Area Debt. Okay. So Strike Debt is building a debt resistance movement. We believe that most individual debt is illegitimate and unjust. Most of us fall into debt because we are increasingly deprived of the means to acquire the basic necessities of life, that is health care, education, and housing. Because we are forced to go into debt simply in order to live, we think it is right and moral to resist it. We also oppose debt because it is an instrument of exploitation and political domination. Debt is used to discipline us, deepen existing inequalities, and reinforce racial, gendered, and other social hierarchies. Every Strike Debt action is designed to weaken the institutions that seek to divide us and benefit from our division. As an alternative to this predatory system, Strike Debt advocates a just and sustainable economy based on mutual aid, common goods, and public affluence. We're excited to hear about your efforts to build this movement that's hopefully going to lead to a mass resistance to lending institutions. So thank you again, JP and Margaret, for being on the show. Our first question is, what is Strike Debt? Like, what does it look like in the Bay Area right now? Because we know there's a nationwide Strike Debt effort. And then what are those different strategies that are maybe unique to the Bay Area or that we're, that Strike Debt is started off with?
Strike Debt Bay Area got started in November with a couple of people who had been connected with Occupy Wall Street, where Strike Debt in general got started, and we've been meeting on a pretty regular basis since then. The first step, of course, is connection and communication for people to get to find other people who share an interest in making these changes, and one of the ways that we've been doing that is by having debtors' assemblies. We had our first debtors' assembly in February in the East Bay, and we're having an upcoming debtors' assembly in San Francisco 2 weeks from yesterday, so that's May 18th. It's from 2 to 5, and it's at the Unite Here Hall, which is at 209 Golden Gate Avenue near the Civic Center BART station. And I wanted to make sure to say that early on. We'll probably repeat it a couple of times, because the Debtors Assembly is a really great way to get introduced to Strike Debt. A large part of the meeting is people breaking down into small groups and talking about their shared experiences with debt and then coming back and strategizing together. So it's really a model of creating community around the shared oppression. We also have a segment in which we provide some political analysis of why we're all in debt together. So that's a main thing that we've been working on. We have five different working groups or affinity groups that are going at the moment. One of these is the Debtors Union, and the Debtors Union is a new concept. You know, we used to feel that people could get organized around workplace issues, but nowadays many people, you know, do not have ongoing work, and the existing union structure has been pretty corrupted. So we're trying to figure out what it would mean to have a union based around the shared being in debt. We're just starting to think this through. We welcome new ideas about that. And one of our thoughts is to do some kind of an action, a collective action together. Do you want to speak to what that might be, or do you want me to continue?
Keep going.
Okay.
Good. So
one of our thoughts, and this is just a thought, we haven't implemented it yet, but if you're interested, come join us, would be to collect a bunch of people who have credit card debt with the same institution, the same bank, and collect people who are banking with that bank who don't necessarily have credit card debt. And the people who have debt, you know, may be paying unfair interest rates or may be paying a lot of late fees or whatever. And as individuals, they can't get the bank to change that. But what if a bunch of them went to the bank and said, we want you to cut out our late fees and reduce our interest rate by, you know, half. And if you don't do that, we have 1,000 other people who are going to stop depositing with you, sort of the move your money model. We think that big enough institutions probably won't do that negotiation, but it would provide some coverage about what we're doing, because a big part of what we're trying to do right now is build enough people, get enough people involved that we can make some changes in the institutions.
And the debtors union idea is a new idea. You ask what's sort of novel about Strike Debt Bay Area. So Strike Debt New York has done a few things, including they kicked off with what, and we can talk about what the Rolling Jubilee was, and they put together what's called a Debt Resistors Operations Manual. And so we don't want to duplicate what they're doing. So we've been throwing around this idea of putting together some sort of debtors union to piggyback off what they've done and make sort of a separate mark for ourselves, as well as do actions around the Bay Area. We had a tax day action over in San Francisco at the Federal Reserve. And so that's some of what we're doing specifically, as opposed to the whole Strike Debt concept, which is what you were asking.
And I would say that Strike Debt Bay Area is probably operating on multiple levels. At our first debtors union, we made connection with the East Bay Community Law Center, which provides legal assistance to people who are facing lawsuits over debt. And the Debt Resistors Operators Manual similarly has solutions for individuals, as well as analysis of the social situation as a whole. So we are trying to direct people to existing resources, and more importantly, trying to figure out new resources, create new resources. One of the other working groups is the Alternative Institutions Working Group, and some of the people in that are working with the Public Banking Institute, which is going to have a big conference at the beginning of June. People can check that out online. Public banking is an alternative to the predatory banks that are just based around making money, and is more of a community resource. So we're hoping to establish public banking in California. And there are also people in the Alternative Institution Working Group who are working on the idea of alternative currencies or complementary currencies that aren't part of the whole Federal Reserve system. So we're looking at institutional change, personal change, and alternative concepts going along within the current society. We're trying to work on many levels at once, whatever most appeals to you.
Debt is usually like a really like shameful it becomes a very like individualized personal experience. Can you talk about like the context of debt in the United States right now? I know it's a global issue and problem, but people usually see it as like, oh, this person like overspent or wasn't thinking, or a conspicuous consumption. But I think Strike Debt, you guys have a very different analysis and a set of information that makes debt, takes it the shame away, because it's more of a system problem rather than like people making bad choices or something. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So when you had asked, I had written as an answer that, just to address what you're saying, that Strike Debt is the realization that, you know, pay your debts or feel ashamed, it's a meme imposed by the institutions that don't have to pay their debts and never feel ashamed, right? And this has been running through the whole thing. You have to pay your debts. You grow up with that thing, and then all of a sudden, we come up with this realization that these organizations are, you know, they're causing the entire economy to crash, and then they don't have to pay their debts. They don't have to do restitution. They don't have to pay their debts, you know. And hopefully we can build on that realization that there's something wrong here, right? There's really something fundamentally wrong with this whole concept of this is what is happening, right? And on a personal level, this is a quote from some of the websites. I mean, you know, debt keeps us individuals isolated, ashamed, and afraid, you know, and we're trying to build a movement to challenge that, right, and create alternatives that support each other. We want an economy where our debts are to our friends, our families, and our communities, and not to the 1% or the financial institutions or you know, the guy with the club coming after you to pay your debt,
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Yeah, I mean, for the 1%, the people at the top level of the economy, debt is a way of doing business. It's just routine. They're borrowing and lending all the time. And as we saw in 2008, if they borrow more than they can pay back, they get bailed out, you know. But when we look at what do consumers, what does the 99% get in debt for, the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country is medical debt. 61% of bankruptcies are caused by medical debt. 3/4 of those people have health insurance. So if we had a single-payer health plan, people would not go into debt and into bankruptcy over health care. You know, similarly, I hardly need to say anything about the mortgage crisis because that's gotten tremendous publicity over the last 5 years. You know, but another issue that people are not as aware of is car loans. 70% of people who buy their cars take out a loan to do that, so they're paying that off over years. And there's this new thing called predatory car equity or car title loans, predatory car title loans, I guess it's what it's called. You know, if you need some money, you can borrow on the equity in your car. And they take spare keys to your car, and they put a GPS in your car. So if you don't pay, they take your car. But they still charge like over 100% interest as if it was an unsecured loan, even though they have this collateral of your car to take away. So this, I mean, every time you turn around, there's a new way that debt is being used to enrich the people who are already wealthy and enslave and impoverish the people who are poor, you know. And we think about credit card debts is because people are, you know, the myth is people get in credit card debt because they're greedy, you know. Well, number one, many times people get in credit card debt because they have debts for paying for going to school and debts for medical care and debts for buying a car because there isn't good public transit, you know. So that's one thing. You know, the other thing is our entire economy is built on growing consumption, you know. So we're going to have a whole change in things if people stop consuming. People are doing what they've been told to do when they go into credit card debt, and then they get blamed that it's their fault. You know, it's a between a rock and a hard place, no win kind of a situation. So these are some of the things that we talk about feeling like you're not in debt because you're bad, you're in debt because of a structural system that makes sure that you get there, wants you to be there, needs you to be there, you know, and then blames you for being there.
Mm-hmm. How are, because I know there's an outreach affinity group that's part of Strike Debt Heart. How do people react when you sort of present them with like a new way of looking at debt? And is it something that is still very new, like a very new thought, or do you think after, because of Occupy, people are maybe realizing more? So how has outreach, or how does it look like in the Bay Area?
I think it's a mixture. I mean, you get people who come up to you and you know are saying, yeah, exactly, you know, that's right on, that's what happened to me. And you still get the people who come, I mean, we had a few people at our action who came by and were shouting, I paid my mortgage, you know, why should, you know, this kind of thing. You try and talk to them, but so there's a mixture, and that illustrates that there is this divide still. There is this meme that people have grown up with, that it's absolutely critical that you pay your debts, and you know, to not do so is shameful and must be hidden, and if you don't, there's something wrong with you. But I think more and more people are being receptive to the ideas we're presenting, you know. Not that we want people to just, you know, abandon you know, if you borrow 20 from me, well, too bad, you know. But there has to be a realization that, there, again, I go back, there's something fundamentally, like, wrong here if people are forced into debt slavery and these institutions, you know. And I think, you know, it's slow, it's hard, but I think to some extent it's getting through. It's, I mean, nobody, everybody... If you look at public opinion polls or something, everybody hates the banks. I mean, it's just a matter of translating that into some actionable thing that people can do because they're stuck.
And I think that the housing crisis had a big effect on how people think about debt, and I think that the student loan crisis does too, because you know a whole generation of people are entering the workforce where not only are there not decent jobs, but they have huge amounts of debt. There was just a recent article about veterinarians who want to work with large animals, cattle and horses, you know, which is clearly needed in rural America, but that doesn't pay well enough to pay off their $120,000 loan, so they have to go deal with, you know, poodles and, you know, what. I can't even think of the names of these fancy dogs, cockapoos and stuff, where people will spend a lot of money for their care. You know, so that's another example of how, you know, debt just distorts the whole economy as well as people's personal choices. And I think more and more people are becoming aware of that.
So something that we do as, you know, Zapatistas is, or we've learned from the Zapatistas is this idea of solidarity and struggling where you're at. And, you know, solidarity doesn't mean like, you know, sending money and being charitable, but it means, yeah, it means to learn about struggle and share strategies. So on the website, it talked about the growing global movement against debt and austerity. So how are, is there a sharing that's happening on a global level with strike debt as a strategy and maybe what strike debt has learned from other countries that are also dealing with predatory lending and credit, like bad credit and things like that?
I think we're just getting started. We're much too young for that. I think we want to learn a lot more about what happened in Iceland, because I think that's a shining example of turning around the debt situation. I know there's a strike debt in the UK, but we haven't made connections with them. But I think, you know, aside from the issue of international solidarity, you know, that we are working in terms of solidarity locally, you know, so like we're collaborating with people like the Public Banking Institute folks. You know, we're going to go to the, some of us are going to go to the day of demonstration against Goldman Sachs. You know, Goldman Sachs, like Wells Fargo, moved their shareholders meeting to Salt Lake City, but there are going to be demonstrations anyway, you know, around town. So the thing is that debt just so permeates every other issue. I'm sure we can even figure out a connection between debt and the prison industrial complex, even though I guess there are a little bit of debtors' assemblies getting started. But so it's very easy to collaborate because, you know, issues of you know, class and race are just really tied in.
I will point out that the sort of the fight against austerity is now coming to fore. If you look at the papers over the last few weeks or months, more and more people are coming out, in a sense, saying austerity was wrong. You know, there was a debunking of one of the original papers on austerity that you know said the countries couldn't go into debt up beyond a certain limit or they would die, basically. And you know, this has wreaked economic havoc among European countries and to some extent the United States, and has caused worse debt and you know more and more people to go into debt as opposed to governments. And so this is slowly coming out. It's more and more into the public awareness that and you know we're fomenting that as best we can. But it's interesting to see it just slowly work its way up into the public consciousness, further and farther from, you know, the mortgage crisis to medical debt, to just the general notion that this whole concept that people have been floating around of austerity and stuff is just a radically bad idea.
Well, Well, I go even a step further in the whole idea of capitalism is a really bad idea, you know. And you know, some people say, well, it's this particular stage of capitalism, which is all about finance rather than about production of goods and services. Mm-hmm. You know, in something like this, twice as much money in the gross national product from finance than from production. You know, which is clearly totally distorted. So some people say, you know, we can just get back to a kind of capitalism that isn't so distorted by finance. And others of us say, you know, as long as you're dealing with something that's about profit, you know, you're building in oppression of various forms. And we see talking about debt as a way to help people understand the nature of the capitalist system and the way, it, you know, it's not an accident that we're having increased inequality, income inequality. You know, it's built into the system.
So I teach this social movements class to eighth graders, and all they're always asking me, what happened to Occupy?
That's a whole other program.
Yeah, and I tell them, well, people organizing, you know, building from Occupy, because we're always, you know, you want to keep changing your strategy.
Can I interrupt to say, if you bring them down on a Sunday at 2 o'clock to Oscar Grant Plaza, they'll see there are at least a couple of dozen people there talking about what they're still doing as part of Occupy.
Yeah.
So it's not dead. It's not hundreds of people in the streets, but it's, you know, core people communicating every week and being involved in a wide range of projects around town.
Yeah, so I wanted you to talk more about what are some of the victories from Occupy that Strike Debt is building on. And then I'll follow up that, of course, with what are some of the lessons.
Right.
I think we've already kind of addressed that, but, you know, I think the three big victories, in a sense, from Occupy is simply putting out there the meme that banks got bailed out, we got sold out, right? And that got put, you know, very much into the awareness of the community, and is part of the realization why people hate banks so much now, right? And then even broader than that, just, I mean, the Occupy movement, when it started, the idea of the vast inequality in the nation, and as it's gone on, the growing inequality in the United States, not just as it is, but it's continuing to grow, that fact, you know, again, getting out into the general public and people becoming aware of that, right, is hate it. And third, I think, one of the big successes, if you will, of the Occupy movement was the spawning of a number of foreclosure defense groups, okay, which have had some limited but definite successes fighting the banks, stopping foreclosures, stopping evictions, and I think that has gotten some publicity. And so the notion that you can actually fight the bank and actually win sometimes, I think is important for people to know. And it's gotten out there.
And you can see that's a model for the kind of thing we were thinking about in terms of credit card, and dealing with credit card debt. So the idea of fighting the banks is really profound. I think one of the things that everyone said from the get-go about the Occupy movement was that the slogan about the 99% and the 1% was absolutely brilliant, you know, and it brought the concept of class into public discourse. You know, it used to be nobody was talking about class, and it's become common knowledge that we're in a class society with growing inequality, and Occupy had a lot to do with that idea becoming acceptable, that meme, as JP calls it, being understood more generally.
And what are some lessons? So there were many victories, and then there were things that I think, you know, we all learned from in terms of organizing ourselves, in terms of how we talk to each other, in terms of how we... everybody might have different solutions, so how do you, like, compromise? So what are some lessons or strategies that you are applying to Strike Debt that you learned from the Occupy experience, or are learning from the Occupy experience?
You have the
Well, following up on what I just said, you know, I think that the beginning of the Occupy movement came out of the issue of economic inequality. And particularly in Oakland, you know, a lot of people said, oh, Occupy went down the wrong path because it got into police brutality. I mean, police brutality is very much tied to economic inequality because they don't beat up a lot of bankers, right? You know, they're looking for other victims. So, you know, in a way, we're returning to one of the root issues in a very direct way. At the same time, as that root issue is tied into all these other issues, and, you know, we recognize the need to work collaboratively with people who are working on all these other equally important, you know, like I said before, single-payer healthcare, for example, you know, or public transit, you know, or anti-racist struggles. All these things tie in together. I think that one of the things that I think some of us have learned, and some of us may be new going into Occupy and have gotten really reinforced within Occupy, is the need to create structures for sustainable activism, because we're not going to make this change overnight. You know, it's the institutions and political and economic institutions arrayed against us are extremely powerful, and the tools of surveillance, as we have learned in the last few weeks, are pretty intense. And it's going to take a while to build a big enough movement and to come up with creative solutions. We need to be able to hang in there for the long run, you know, and not think that getting 40,000 people to shut down the port one day is the day before revolution. You know, so I think figuring out how do we keep going. You know, one of the things that I've noticed as an older activist is that a lot of the young people that I work with disappeared because they got a job somewhere else, or, you know, their lover got a job somewhere else, or they had to make more money than they could make being in the movement. They had to work more. You know, we have to figure out, and this has always been an issue for progressive movements, we have to figure out how people can contribute at whatever time level that they have, you know, and feel okay about that, and build on everybody's energy, not have people getting burned out. I think a lot of people in Occupy really knocked themselves out and got burned out. So those, I think, are big lessons. I mean, I think another thing that I just keep being aware of, because I still go to the Occupy General Assemblies, you know, is that we're dealing with people who grew up under capitalism, and we've internalized a lot of bad stuff. You know, even people who are trying to be anti-racist and anti-sexist and anti-homophobic, you know, have unconscious stuff about that. Just at the meeting today, somebody was talking about people should go out and man the something or others, and it was about a rival radio station. And we said, no, women, staff, people, whatever, not man. But, you know, so there's all that. I mean, that's a trivial example, but, you know, there are all these examples where those kinds of biases come up, you know, narcissistic, egocentric behaviors taking the stage, you know, people being rude, shouting one another down. A lot of this is because we were brought up in a competitive, you know, society, and how to figure out how to live cooperatively and how to work cooperatively and how to, you know, collectivize and support one another. It's an ongoing thing that we have to work with at the same time as we're working on institutional change. Well, you can probably hear I'm a feminist from the 60s. You know, the personal is political. We have to be working on all those levels at once. And it's really hard. I mean, when you have a diverse movement that's got people of all ages and lots of races and many, you know, different first languages and different class backgrounds growing up, it's going to be tough, but it's essential.
Thank you. Well, thank you again for coming in and taking the time to share history and a little bit of history from Occupy, and then this new initiative, Strike Debt, which I think is going to be get a lot of attention here in the Bay Area. But I also want to open the last couple minutes up to any upcoming meetings, events, or actions, and anything you want to add.
Yeah, I want to read a quote from Francis Fox Piven. Just as bosses are dependent on workers, so are lenders dependent on borrowers. If workers walk out, the enterprise stops. It's getting less true with automation. But if borrowers refuse to pay their debts, the lenders could be in real trouble. Each side depends on the other. The millions of underwater mortgage holders, of student debtors, and credit card holders need bank loans, But some of the banks need those borrowers, and they especially need them to cooperate by paying their monthly charges. Otherwise, the capital that the banks list on their books begins to drain away. So we have enormous power if we recognize it. And the last thing I'll say is that we have our next debtors assembly on May 18th, which is a week from next Saturday. It's from 2 to 5 in San Francisco at the Unite Here Union Hall, 209 Golden Gate Avenue. It'll be a chance for people to share personal experiences and feel connected with other people dealing with similar issues, as well as getting some analysis of how this mess was imposed on us all.
Okay. And if you missed out on the date, you could always Google Strike Debt Bay Area, and their Tumblr page has a lot of information and upcoming meetings. Are your meetings every month? The assemblies every month?
No, the assemblies are periodic, but we do have a once-a-month meeting that we call Strategy into Action, and those alternate between the East Bay and San Francisco. Our next one will be in San Francisco on June 1st, and it's going to be at 518 Valencia Street in the Mission from 3 to 5:30, and then the following one will be in July in the East Bay in downtown Oakland. So that will be posted on the website.
On the theme of Occupy Isn't Dead, the Occupy has a foreclosure defense group, which fights the banks and their mortgages, and we meet every Sunday at 12:30 p.m. At 19th and Telegraph by the statues in the park there, and everyone is welcome to come and help us keep people in their homes.
Thank you, JP and Margaret, again.
Thank you for giving us this chance.
No problem. If you want the full interview, it should be up on the radioautonomia.wordpress.org website later this week. We're going to go to a musical break, and when we come back, we'll go to part two of the show.
Y alegre.
Dice,
pasaporte. ¿A dónde vamos, Ay, con Hilario? Con esta noche tan fea. ¿Usted no se anima? Mire cómo está el camino. Anegadito.
No, hombre, ¿cómo? El camino es lo de menos.
Lo importante es llegar.
Tengo dos latidos, dos.
Latidos de mi identidad.
Somos idénticos.
Para que yo los finalizar.
Tengo tranquilito.
Para lo que ya no están.
Nómada sin rumbo, la energía negativa yo la derrumbo. Con mis pezuñas de cordero, me propuse a recorrer el continente entero. Sin brújulas, sin tiempo, sin agenda, inspirado por las leyendas, por historias empaquetadas en lata. Por los cuentos que la luna relata, aprendí a caminar sin mapa, a irme de caminata, sin comodidades, sin lujo, protegido por los santos y los brujos. Aprendí a escribir cabronerías en mi libreta y con un mismo idioma sacudir todo el planeta. Aprendí que mi pueblo todavía reza porque las fucking autoridades y la puta realeza todavía se mueven por debajo de la mesa. Aprendí a tragarme la depresión con cerveza. Mi patrono yo lo escupo de las montañas y con mi propia saliva enveneno su champaña. Enveneno su champaña. Sonrisa, yo veo una guerrilla, una aventura, un movimiento. Pulen. lenguaje, tu acento. Yo quiero descubrir lo que ya estaba descubierto. Ser un emigrante, ese es mi deporte. Hoy me voy pa'l norte, sin pasaporte, sin transporte. A pie con las patas, pero no importa, este hombre se hidrata. Por lo que retratan mis pupilas, cargo con un par de paisajes en mi mochila. Cargo con vitamina de clorofila. Cargo con un rosario que me vigila. Sueño con cruzar el meridiano, resbalando por las cuerdas del 4 de Aureliano y llegarle tempranito, temprano a la orilla. Por el desierto con los pies a la parrilla. Por debajo de la tierra, como las ardillas, yo voy a cruzar la muralla. Yo soy un intruso con identidad de recluso. Y por eso me convierto en buzo. Y buceo por debajo de la tierra, pa' que no me vean los guardias y los perros no me huelan. Abuela, no se preocupe, que en mi cuello cuelga la Virgen de la Guadalupe.
You are listening to Radio Autonomia, Zapatismo in the Bay, and we're about to go to interview slash discussion around the prison industrial complex and prisons and the effect they have on the Oakland community and communities of color and lower income communities. But before that, we wanted to highlight a CD that was produced by the Prison Radio Project and Freedom Archives a few years ago, and it's entitled Prisons on Fire, George Jackson, Attica, and Black Liberation. And we're going to be playing a couple songs or a couple sound bites from the CD interspersely through the interview and then also the after the interview. And if you're interested in the CD and you're interested in what you're hearing or you like what you're hearing, you can pick it up on the Freedom Archives website. The first song that we're going to do is entitled The Marin County Rebellion, and it's kind of an archival soundbite from that rebellion. So we'll be back in just a second.
Our battleground, our battlefield.
David Johnson.
It wasn't in isolation with what was taking place outside, because as people start to raise their voices about civil rights violations and human rights violations, then brothers inside, through civil litigation, through protests, strikes, and stuff like that, fought to gain their civil rights and human rights.
August 7, 1970, just a short time after George Jackson was transferred to San Quentin Prison, the Soledad Brothers case was catapulted to the forefront of national news when George's brother, Jonathan, a 17-year-old high school student in Pasadena, led a raid on the Marin County Courthouse with a satchel full of handguns, an assault rifle, and a shotgun hidden under his coat. Educated as a political revolutionary by his brother, Jonathan invaded the court during a hearing for three San Quentin inmates, not including his brother, and handed them weapons. As Jonathan left the courthouse, leading the three prisoners and five hostages, including the judge, he demanded that the Soledad brothers be released. Prison guards and other authorities opened fire on the escape van, killing Jonathan Jackson, William Christmas, James McLean, and the judge. Only one black prisoner, Rochelle McGee, survived what has become known as the Marin County Rebellion. Rochelle McGee.
This is one of the reasons I fight so hard, fight back, and will continue to do so with the belief that I've always had. As long as you fight, nobody know how the fight gonna come out. It's a possibility I might win, but I know if I stop, I cannot win. I also believe that one man can make a difference if he's sincere.
Of Jonathan, George wrote, "He was free for a while. I guess that's more than most of us can expect." George Jackson, recorded in San Quentin before his murder.
I don't think that it's fair to Jonathan Jackson. I don't think it's fair to William Christmas or to James McLean or Brother McGee. I don't think it's fair at all to try to bury those brothers' examples.
You know, Jonathan sacrificed his life for the cause of freeing his brother and all of those who were unjustly imprisoned.
There wouldn't be one thing that could stop those brothers from attaining what they started out to do. I think it was well thought out. The mistake was in underestimating the viciousness of the prison guards.
David Hilliard.
Jonathan Jackson made an attempt to free George and other political prisoners. Certainly a revolutionary action. Jonathan and the judge and William Christmas and James McLean were all killed in that event. And Michelle McGee, who still lingers in prison, was also a part of that attempt to free those brothers from prison.
Yeah. such a weak emotion, that's why I despise it. We scared of almost everything, afraid to even tell the truth. So scared of what you think of me, I'm scared of even telling you. Sometimes I'm like the only person I feel safe to tell it to. I'm locked inside a cell in me, I know that there's a gel in you. Consider this your belling out, so take a breath and hell a few. My screams is finally getting free, my thoughts is finally getting down.
Political incarceration removes threats to the political and economic hegemony of the United States. Even though in 1959, George Jackson initially went to prison as an everyday lawbreaker with a one-year-to-life sentence, it was his political consciousness that kept him incarcerated for 11 years.
One of the important achievements of the movement during that period was to do what George Jackson called the transformation of a criminal consciousness into a political consciousness.
Angela Davis.
And this was precisely what he took on. And no one can deny that there were many people then, as now, committing antisocial acts against members of their communities, members of other communities.
So that when you leave these institutions and go back to your communities, you can be an asset to your community and not a predator.
David Johnson.
And a lot of brothers embrace that concept.
He did a lot of studying.
Luis Bato Talamantes, prison activist and former prisoner.
And he was persistent in talking to me and other Chicano brothers who had no real interest nor inclination to even be political. We were still kind of like inclined to be criminal.
I would say from 1968 on, I began to grow.
Willie Sundiata Tate, prison activist and former prisoner.
Through other people who was in prison, by them like sharing information and just stimulating me to use my brain to not just exist, you know.
For the first 4 years, I read in economics, pure economics.
George Jackson.
The second 4 years, I read in exclusively in military things, you know, World War II, Mao Zedong. I read the criminal stuff, I read Jacques. People's Army, People's War. Went through the whole gambit, the whole thing, the whole line.
George Jackson always referring to the Vietnamese people soldiers, the Viet Cong as comrades.
Bato Talamantes.
And George Jackson was a little bit, with a nice smile. George Jackson really kind of had a big smile, and he would kind of like get a twinkle in his eye, and he would kind of lead you down this thing going, and show you a very simple, kind of like an educational way so that you didn't feel like he was talking over you, putting you down. He would show you step by step how your mind got manipulated into rooting for the wrong side. See?
You're tuned in to Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM in the East Bay, and you're listening to Radio Autonomia, Autonomy Radio, a Zapatismo in the Bay. And we just heard Prisons on Fire, produced by Freedom Archives and Prison Radio Project. And we're going into another segment where we're looking at prisons and their effects on our communities. And in various spaces and projects this past month, we have heard from critical conversations around prisons and the prison industrial complex and stories of community resiliency and community regeneration. From Critical Resistance, April issue of the Abolitionists, focusing on mental health and resiliency, to the recent publication and book tour conversation of Maroon the Implacable, the collected writings of Russell Maroon Schultz. We have heard questions posed and strategies shared around what it takes for individuals and communities to stay resilient, connected, and strong in the midst of the prison industrial complex. We have also heard analysis of the various ways the prison and the prison industrial complex enacts violence on communities of color and lower income communities. We found these conversations timely given the recent increased presence and popularity of zero tolerance, lifestyle quality policing, suppression style policing in and within Oakland. This style of policing has been articulated through the gang injunctions of 2011 and the hiring of William Brenton and Bob Wasserman, and the increased presence of ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, and raids within many Oakland communities.
So in that sense, we wanted to bring you all together, and thank you, Manuel and Anita, for coming into the studio today. We wanted to continue these critical conversations on the radio so it maybe gets out to more folks and just to keep these types of conversations going. And in this conversation, we also wanted to name the symbolic and physical violence that the prison industrial complex bring to communities of color and lower-income communities in the Bay Area. And we wanted to kind of frame it a little bit and talk more about what strategies and projects and spaces, communities that you all are part of or maybe involved in, are using to build resiliency and regenerate the community in the face of this type of violence. So first off, we just wanted to have you all introduce yourselves on the show, and then talk a little bit about what projects you all are currently working on, are working within, and the different movements you're a part of.
My name is Anita Wills, and I'm an activist in the community. I've worked with the Oscar Grant Committee in the past. I'm a member of All of Us in None. I'm a member of Occupy for Prisoners. And we're working on a People's Community Database project right now. Another project that I'm working on is very important to me is to request that the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, and the Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris, investigate the wrongful conviction of my son, who is in prison in the California state prison system. So I have a petition that is going around, but those are the projects that I'm working on right now.
My name is Manuel LaFontaine, and I am a father, an uncle, a son, and a formerly incarcerated person. Most important, I'm a human being, and I need to emphasize that because the minute anyone here in America is convicted of a crime and sentenced, we are then labeled all these subhuman characteristics that allows the state and multinational corporations to attack us through their media, CBS, NBC, Fox, and whatnot. So I think it's important for many of us who have been incarcerated to come out the closet, if we haven't already, and speak to the violence that's being used through the language. And I'm also a proud member of All of Us and None, and we're focusing on many different campaigns. One of the most important ones is trying to bring to light and amplify the voices of people right now being held in solitary confinement in what many of us could have called, you know, prisons within prisons, control units, control dungeons, and their plight to be looked as human beings and not be labeled and treated as the worst of the worst here in America, particularly in California.
Great. So we wanted to start off the conversation talking about the specific effects. So a lot of us think of, when we think of prisons, we think of them as isolated places, not only geographically, but also in the sense of who's related to them, right? So we wanted to talk more specifically about what effects does the prison, the symbolic, the physical prison, but also the symbolic prison have on the communities here, right? And some of us have named the prison industrial complex or low intensity warfare and how that plays out, but we were just wanting to see begin the conversation of what effects do you all think that has, both physical and then also symbolic.
It's important, I think, to first recognize that we cannot talk about violence in America without talking about the social, economic, and environmental violence that's being put out by the institutions here in America. And we, as people, poor people, people of color, have been conditioned to see violence through the eyes of the oppressor. And to make it clear who's the oppressor is the state, the multinational corporations, the military, and all those institutions that allow the status quo to continue, where capitalism stays, thrives, stays alive. And many of us, of course, are trying to fight against that. Because when we're conditioned, then we sometimes can only see the violence through our own behavior, as opposed to looking at the state and the institutions that are promoting violence, that make and produce violent human beings. So I think we have to go from that underlying premise, because if not, then we start looking at the individual or individuals as opposed to looking at the systems. And I have to go back to that, because I could assume responsibility for my actions, still don't negate so many the lives of so many people, particularly women and children, who are being incarcerated through these practices that then put the blame on the individual.
I want to go back to after the Civil War, when they were setting up camps for the newly freed slaves. And they called them work camps, but they were putting them in these camps, which were nothing but prisons, and forcing them to labor, to work for free. The same thing that they had been doing in, you know, before slavery ended. This was mostly in the South. The reason I want to go back to that and come back to today, what is going on today, which is touching my life and affecting my life, is that my son was a carpenter. He was a journey level carpenter. He's a journey level machinist. He worked all of his, you know, his adult life, and made good money. Today he's working and he's making maybe 25 cents an hour for the prison industrial complex. And when I say wrongful conviction, he's not the only one that's in prison wrongfully convicted. He's not the only one who refused to cooperate with the district attorney and take a plea, you know, and then have the district attorney come back and maliciously prosecute him because he refused to just say that he committed a crime that he said he did not commit. He's an African-American male. He was 31 years old at the time. And what they used to convict him, you know, he was supposed to be on trial for second-degree murder, but there was no evidence that he ever committed that crime. So they convicted him for being a drug dealer. They convicted him for being a gang member. And they talked that up to the white jury, all white jury, who already sees our young men as drug dealers and gang members. So that's the way they spent the trial. And that's what he was convicted for. Because the DA, nor the Oakland Police Department, had any information that my son actually committed the crime that he was accused of. But the point was to get him in jail, to use him as an example, to have the Oakland Tribune running articles, calling him names, you know, calling him a drug dealer, calling him a felon, and calling him all these different names, along with the court system, you know. And during this time, the mayor of Oakland was Jerry Brown. This was in 2001. He was the mayor of Oakland, and he was, you know, tough on crime because he was going to eventually run for governor. But I'm saying that to make the connection between the politicians, the courts. The courts were willing to overlook the fact that there was no evidence and allow the trial to proceed. The DA was allowed to do whatever was necessary to get this man tried on three strikes. They did not look at the family, the fact that he is a father, and 60% of my grandchildren's income ended when my son was arrested. You know, that affected them greatly. Their father has been out of their lives. One of them was murdered. You know, he's dead. He's 19 years old. This is how it affects my life. But I see that in the community where these men are taken out and taken away and put in prison for, you know, for little or nothing and given a lot of time. And a lot of these men are taking pleas. They're just saying, okay, I'll take the plea. And they don't understand that that's going to stay on their records and follow them. You know, it's like almost like a death sentence. You know, they won't be able to find employment. They won't be able to get an education. They won't be able to live, you know, have families. So it's a whole, you know, like it's, the prison industrial complex is not just about being arrested and going to prison. It's so much more than that. And the last thing I want to mention is that there are private prisons, and Jerry Brown is talking about, you know, keeping these men in prison, in these private prisons, you know, because they're being regulated by the feds. And they're selling on Wall Street. And Wells Fargo is one of the banks who has stockholders who own stocks in the private prison system. So this country is run on the, you know, on the exploitation of cheap labor. And the prison industrial complex is part of that. It's part of this whole crazy, you know, capitalist system. So that's all I have to say.
So, kind of in response to thinking through or the ways that the prison and the prison industrial complex has affected our communities, what kind of community regeneration process or practices and projects do you know of or are you part of that are responding to these effects or responding to the prison industrial complex?
Before I go into providing some solution, I wanted to go back and just state that I know that many of us get caught up in using terms and slogans that we understand well. We as activists, revolutionary thinkers, critical thinkers, like slogans like end mass incarceration, you know, prison industrial complex, and we recognize why we use that. And at the same time, we have to recognize the state learns how to simplify language that then we can adopt and co-opt and then throw back, and our own family members will use that to keep us confused. And what I mean by that, for example, is, and I think I'm going to read something that Russell Maroon Schultz has written in the book Maroon the Implacable. He says, "We are involved in a cultural war, which has many fronts, political, economic, social, moral, and ethical. They call it a war on poverty, quote, a war on crime, a quote, unquote, war on drugs, or a war on childhood disease, unquote. And tomorrow they will make up another deceptive title to maneuver behind. You know, however, it's the idea of behaviors, institutions of America in their many forms that are being fought over. If you do not recognize this fact, then your soul will be stolen by your enemy, by our enemy, and used to fuel the machine." He goes on to say they are death dealers and death merchants, and they destroy anyone that threatens to slow down or expose their mindless accumulation of wealth, power, and control. It makes no difference whether you are the innocent, the young, or the elderly. If you cannot add to the accumulation of power, they will grind you to dust. Still more, they will vilify, mock, and otherwise distort you, who you are, to the end of getting everyone on their side. So it's going back that we as critical thinkers have to create language that and terminologies that will be accessible to our own mothers, to our own theos and grandfathers, that sometimes we may disregard and dismiss them as saying, well, you know, we can't change them. But I find that really hard to believe when I'm challenging everyone around me, and now they're starting to look at incarceration at a different way. And so that goes back to one way is that when we're having this conversation, we come home from a long day of activism, from march or from work, that we can have conversations with our own family members and try to be patient, trying to allow them to see that our critical thinking has taken years in many ways. For me, it took so many years inside a cage, which takes us back to these control units I want to briefly talk about. So these control units here in America are the best practice being used by imperialism, by governments that want to create such a capitalistic mindset and therefore allow that their tentacles to spread elsewhere and keep those who are standing up against them quiet. And these control units have been spreading out throughout America. In California, we call them security housing units. And to all our viewers, audience, listeners, imagine being held in a space as big as your bathroom, the smallest bathroom or the smallest room in your house. And It's about 10 by 6 with no human contact, with no sunlight available, with no human interaction for a month, for 6 months, for 5 years, for 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. That's just an imagination. This is the reality, the truth for so many people right now in California and throughout America. I mean, you can go internationally throughout Guantanamo Grave, throughout Abu Ghraib, and all these places that the United States has its tentacles at. So many folks are rising up, and a couple years ago on July of 2011, folks decided to go on a hunger strike. So many folks may ask, why go on a hunger strike when that is self-destructive? Well, when you have no other method to employ to allow folks to hear your cry, the cry of being tortured, being held indefinitely, then you sometimes have to use your body as the last resort to then get people to hear you and see if they can support you. And I think Maroon, again, briefly, I'm going to touch back on something that he says that is important. He says, this is page 25 of his book, Maroon the Implacable. As a warden of the first U.S. prison control unit set up by the government of Marion, Illinois, stated in the open court, quote, control units are designed to control and suppress revolutionary tendencies in the country. And for those who are not familiar with that, with what control units are, just let me say that they are prisons within prisons, an archipelago from one end of the United States to the other. These torture camps have been condemned by the United Nations representative on torture, but remain in place because they are said to hold the worst of the worst. He goes on to say, shortly, the technicians, quote-unquote, who run these places have developed, quote-unquote, clean torture techniques that are primarily designed to break your mind, to break your will to resist, to co-opt you as a willing pawn in their war to pacify and exploit you for the service of capital. They're designed to keep you controlled by your entire sentence until you are dead. So that's one of our campaigns, is to raise these voices that are coming from, for example, Russell Maroon Schultz. He's been down over 40 years in another prison outside of California that many people within the state of California can identify with in the conditions he's describing. So it's important for us as next steps to figure out how can we become more aware of what's going on to people inside control units. And I'm part of a coalition called the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition. And if you were to put this Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity just on Google, you'll be able to find our website. And there's many ways that people can support. And after others here can speak to, I can also provide more specific ways.
Just one thing that you mentioned, and I think we could have a little bit longer conversation about, is that how the control units are set up to actually control revolutionary thought, right? So when people think of the SHU or control units, they think of, like, you know, that prison inside the prison where, like, people for some reason can't hang in the general population, so they're forced to put there. But I think what that text you just stated is kind of debunking that myth, right? It's actually how you control so people don't rise up in the prisons. They're revolutionary thoughts, so they're actually imprisoning ideas or people who have the revolution ideas. But what's the theme of the show is how prisons isolate, right? So maybe we could, if you could share a little bit more about that process of actually taking, and I know Schultz isn't the only one who has been imprisoned in these higher intensity control units for the revolutionary ideas that he has.
Right, and it gets deeper, because some of you wondering, right, for washing the dishes or, you know, getting ready for tomorrow, for the start of the week, that, well, I could hear him, or I could hear Anita, or I could hear this show, but I can't really identify with, because I don't really know anyone being incarcerated. Well, here's the sad reality, that when we're talking about these control units, corporate America is thinking about how to create control units for our children. So these control units can be normalized in the schools. So you got some schools that are adopting, documenting these behavioral modification units for little kids before it was written in all these drugs. Now they're actually creating spaces, physical spaces, to try this out. So what, in 10, 15, or in very short coming, this is something normal. And that's the sad reality that we face. And you raise a good point, that when you create conditions that are torturous, but then you can introduce them and normalize them in our society, that to me is very, very scary, because if you go to places like in East Oakland or even West Oakland, you look at some of these houses and how they're built and how they're looking, and they look like little cages. And that's been normal. That's been accepted by our neighbors, by our community, to be a normal happening. But now if you go to other places that have, like the hills of Oakland Hills, you don't see that. So it's very systemic, and it's done so refined. I think Maroon and others have spoken so good in their books that the level of oppression has been so refined by the powers that be that makes it difficult, if not impossible, to really talk about it and really garner a lot of attention. But stuff like these conditions inside, that many people are saying this can't happen anymore. Because if they allow this to happen and they make it normal, can you imagine what the future is going to look like? Well, you're not even going to have guards, but robots controlling the lives of many people. And there's a lot of documentation that says that when you hold somebody for that long, it's torturing itself, because when you start to capture the mind, see, the body, you can lock it up. But if you have a resisting spirit and you have a spirit, that what I call the ancestral energía and espíritu, and that will to fight back, then it's hard to really capture the mind. And once the mind is captured, however, though, it's easier for anyone to control people. So I think for us is to make these connections. This is not just a conspiracy theory. This is not just left-wing extreme ideology. This is stuff that's happening right now on the auspices of a democratic society. But there's nothing democratic when folks who are the most impacted in society, whether it's working class immigrants who are working the fields to produce the food that we're eating, as well as a lot of the products that are coming out of prisons that people don't recognize that they're wearing, like Victoria's Secret underwear, like some of the hardware that they see in public schools in different places.
And I think another, maybe Anita, you can speak to this in relation to how these tactics that are taking place within the prison, how they're actually affecting families, or in particular women, the work of women organizing outside the prisons, and also young people who are the next that are being targeted for.
Yeah. When Manuel was talking, I was thinking about my son B. When he first went away, they sent him up to High Desert, and he was put in, he was kept on lockdown. In fact, all the blacks were kept on lockdown, because that's what they do in California. If a Hispanic commits a crime, all the Hispanics are put on lockdown. All the blacks are put on lockdown. The only ones that are not all put on lockdown if they commit a crime are the whites. They don't put all the whites on lockdown. So my son was on lockdown. He never touched his son again after he was arrested. When we went to see him, we could only see him for an hour, and he was behind, this window. And, we could go, and it took us, like, all day to get there. So we spend the night, we see him for an hour, and leave. And during this time, he was taken out of his cell and put in ADSEG, which is nothing but the SHU. It's administration segregation, because they were going to move him out of his cell. He was in a cell with someone he was getting along with, and he was like, well, why are you moving us? There's no problem or whatever. And the guards came in and dragged him out and put him in the hole in ADSEG. And I asked him, I hadn't heard from him in like 2 months. I didn't hear from my son. And when I did hear from him, it was through his ex-roommate who had written, ex-cellmate who wrote a letter and said, they have Kerry. I don't know where he is. They've taken him away. And so we went, I called up there, and finally, he was, at that time point, he had been taken to the mental health, or the health, he was in the medical ward. And the nurse, whoever it was I spoke to, I said, why didn't you people call me and tell me my son, he was here? Well, you're not listed as the next of kin. And I'm like, well, he's not married. Who else would be the next of kin? They, And so I spoke to him, And he said, and he told me, he said, Mom, whatever they tell you, don't believe it. He said, I did not try to commit suicide. They said I was trying to commit suicide. He said, and he said, I've been in the cell, and he does not eat pork. And they were trying to feed him something that he thought was pork, and he couldn't see, you know, he said it was dark, and he refused to eat. So they said, he said they dragged him by the neck to the medical ward and told him he was trying to commit suicide. And so this is the way, this is what's going on. But he told me later, he said, Mom, you know what? I will, he said, I found my mind inside that place, inside that hole. He said, I touched a being, you know, I found my consciousness. And he said, nothing they do to me will hurt me from this point on. You know, because I found my consciousness. And, you know, that's like what Manuel was saying about you find that ancestor comes in, that spirit comes in, it either breaks you or makes you. Whatever doesn't kill you will make you stronger. And so I, you know, I felt like he lifted me up when he was talking about, you know, what happened and what he had gone through. And he said, you know what, I know I didn't do this thing. So I can sleep at night. You know, wherever they put me, I know I didn't do this thing. So he's comfortable with that. But the other thing is that with the whole, you know, prison, we're calling it the prison industrial complex, but I want to go back to this manifest destiny, which was what the Europeans said when they came to America. We are a part of their manifest destiny. Their manifest destiny comes at the expense of Native American lands and African slavery. So that's what they're doing. They're using us to manifest their destiny, to make their lives better and richer. And no matter what they do to us, we don't have a right to say anything. We don't have a right to complain. Who are we to complain? You know, this is about them. It's not about us. Even though they claim that, you know, to have given us, you know, this emancipation proclamation or whatever, we're still not free. We can't, you know, we're not allowed to say what we want to say, because we can be shot down. We can go to another country and be talking, and they can send somebody to shoot us down. I'm not saying this. This is what the government says. You know, so where is our freedom? You know, where is the freedom that, you know, supposedly protects us in the Constitution? It's not there. It does not exist. And the prison industrial complex is just part of it. And there's another person's name I want to bring up, Patty Hearst. This, what's going on now, is what Patty Hearst said when she turned into this, you know, when she became a part of the so-called SLA, or, you know, and she was out robbing banks and stuff, and she was saying that this is what they had in mind, to re-enslave the blacks. That's what they had in mind. The capitalist country, you know, this capitalist America wants to, you know, take the land from the natives in Brazil. That's what they're doing right now. If you look at what she said, her manifesto, it's happening right now. She was talking about the bankers. She was talking about what's going to happen, because it's all about power and greed and manifest destiny. And we're not in it. We're not a part of it. You know, so.
So I guess I want to revisit that the question around community regeneration practices and what kind of work specifically are folks doing in your community that helps kind of build resiliency within the community.
So I wanted to go back and appreciate you raising that right now we're organizing around Sawtek Confinement, or more importantly, around July 8th. Now, July 8th is going to be an important day in United States history for this reason. Some people may have heard of Bobby Sands, right, and the struggle of the IRA to be, of Ireland to be recognized by the British Empire as legitimate people and not slaves of the British throne. And Bobby Sands and about 9 other comrades went on a hunger strike to protest their condition of confinement and to demand that they not only be freed, but the conditions of people in Ireland and to be recognized as, again, legitimate human beings. And that's the struggle that we got in Pelican Bay, in Cork, in Tehachapi, in Calipatria, all these places that they have security housing units. So there's some critical thinkers, some folks from inside that provided five ways to support this July 8th impending hunger strike. It might begin, and that can take on 30, 40, 50 days. The last two strikes that happened, I think the first one went for 21 days, the second one for 17. And the only reason they ended it because they wanted the CDCR, the California Department of Correction, and small R for rehabilitation, because that's a contradiction. It's more like retribution than rehabilitation. Was because they, with good faith, wanted to see if CDCR was going to put what they said they would to end the hunger strike. But the five ways that they can support, because the people inside, these are people within the Corcoran shoe, they're saying that CDCR is taking some illegal steps to undermine the impact of the upcoming July 8th peaceful protest and completely control the narrative to detriment of us all. That's their own words. And they say the number one is to demand compliance with the health regulations for hunger strikers. And what this means is that when the hunger strike actually begin, and weeks leading up to it all, they want us and folks who are involved to call Sacramento and each security housing unit that houses each prison, which are four, Pelican Bay, Corcoran, Tehachapi, and Calipatria, and demand that CCR staff comply with the California Correctional Healthcare Services Mass Hunger Strike Fasting and Refeeding Care Guide that was issued in September of 2012, and specifically as it relates to critical input data and diagnostic observation of hunger strike participants by nursing staff. This means that they want folks to weigh them, staff, to look at their blood pressure and body mass index. Mm-hmm. And what we've heard is that some of the staff have said, we're not going to do any of that when the hunger strike. So if they die, basically, oh well, it's not our fault. Mm-hmm. Number two, organize visiting team to the hunger strikers. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they want folks to come together, and we're part of a coalition that can offer support on that. So again, I'm going to reiterate the website to visit. Call the prison if you don't hear from a hunger strike correspondent. They say that if you do not hear from someone you're writing within 7 days of July 8th protest, call the prison immediately and repeatedly inquiring as to your correspondent's welfare and why his or her mail is being withheld. Number four, inundate legislative regular hunger strike updates. So flood them. Let them know what's going on. Because we have to understand that even though many of us believe that a lot of these legislators are being put in there by corporate corporations through their own lobbying efforts, was the CCPOA the biggest, it was not a corporation, but it's still a strong union in California, one of the most strongest, that influenced public policies towards more retributive ways of dealing with in California, creating pre-strike measures and whatnot. It's important for these legislators to not recognize what's really going on, and sometimes they turn a blind eye because they don't want to be perceived to be soft on crime and prohibit their bid in their career, you know, towards becoming the next senator, the next president, or governor of California. And then the last one is try to get mainstream news media coverage of the strike. And this is one of the most hardest ones. As someone who's an activist, and many of us here are activists here in the room at the moment, because we don't control NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN. Then they control who, what stories and how they frame it. Even if they get one of us, if one of us flips it and says something that may not necessarily be aligned with what we're trying to push, they'll put that segment on TV to show the need for more jail, or to show that the worst of the worst are being held and we're advocating because they are demanding that we release them, which they've been using. So we have to understand that. And then the last thing they said, if nothing else, people can donate their time or their treasure to the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition or the Stop the Torture campaign. And they said, this type of struggle is truly a battle for quote-unquote public opinion, another term for cultural hegemony. This type of social change, especially in the capitalist state repressive apparatus, what they call the prisons, where it has enjoyed virtual autonomy, is only going to succeed if social pressure is such that it's clear the culture and society is simply incompatible with this type of torture, and thus the torture must end. So they want us to start supporting them now, and there's many different ways, and I named five, and again, Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity, it's a WordPress, so if people put that in on Google, they should be able to hit the website. That's one other way they can contact me as well.
I'm involved in a pen pal project. We have a pen pal project through Occupy for Prisoners, where we're writing to the prisoners that are in the SHU and keeping them informed about what's going on out here, and they're telling us, you know, what's going on in there. I'm also involved in, I have a petition to have my son's, you know, conviction examined. My son, who went into prison in 2001, a healthy male, now has kidney disease. He's not being treated at the moment for his kidney disease. He's been exposed to TB. He doesn't, to his knowledge, have TB, but now he has to be x-rayed at least once a year. He has to get an x-ray. He said that the prisoner who had TB was left, you know, was left there in a general population. So if he has TB, there's other people there that also have TB, or they were exposed to TB. And so while Jerry Brown is trying to get the feds off of his back, these prisoners are suffering. You know, my son is suffering. He's 350 miles away. I have his 15-year-old son, who's my grandson, lives with me and has just reconnected with his father. And we just can't afford to go there and see him on a regular basis. So, you know, and this is magnified 10,000 times with the amount of these young men who are being taken out of our community. And when I went to see my son at High Desert, it just amazed me, the young Hispanic males that were there, the young African-American males, they look barely teenagers, but they're in a state prison, you know? And that means that there's somebody, they're taking the soul out of our communities and locking them away, you know, for things that they will allow a white male to walk around. If he did that, he can still walk around, he can still retain his freedom. But we can't, because it's, you know, the system, nobody wants to say it out loud, but it's a racist, there's racism, and it's a sickness. Racism is a sickness. So I'm involved in, not only am I involved in organizations, I try to come out and support, you know, the organizations who are out here. You know, there's startup organizations, there's organizations that have been around a long time. They're marching or rallying, and I can get there, then I come out and I support them. And a lot of us don't speak up. We know that it's wrong. We know that it's an injustice, but we don't want to say anything. And we need to get out, and we need to speak up. We need to let our voices be heard. And if not, then we don't have a right to say anything. You know, we take our own power away by sitting silently and allowing this to continue.
Well, thank you, Anita and Manuel. Are there any other announcements that you would like to make in regards to any upcoming spaces or actions related to your work?
I forgot to mention, as I was wrapping up, that there's the author of a book called Out of Control, Nancy Kershon, will be available in San Francisco this upcoming Thursday at 518 Valencia. And she's talking about some of the stuff I was talking about. In fact, I think her work delves into what is solitary confinement, how these control units are being used in society, and particularly, you know, the Marion control unit that was, I quoted earlier. So the book is called Out of Control, A 15-Year Battle Against Control Unit Prisons. Again, Nancy Kershon is the author. I'll be there. So if folks want to know more about what we're trying to do to raise awareness, one of the ways is, of course, getting on Radio Autonomía and just any other places, folks here that are available in Canada, Mexico, wherever we're being listened at the moment. Use your privileges. That's one of my, I tell this everywhere I go. Use your privilege, that being a male, that being educated, that having access to a DOD or someone that has a radio show, as little as it is or as huge as it is. Try to figure out this, how do we raise at least a discussion that can speak about solitary confinement and about torture.
I have a book. I'm an author. I've written three books, and my third book is called Black Meek with the Life and Times of Henry Green, and it is about the incarceration of black males in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, prior to the Civil War. And the reason they were incarcerated is that there was a slave, you know, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. And when this Fugitive Slave Act was passed, that meant that the Southern slave owners could come into the North and run out and get their slaves. You know, before that, they didn't have the power. The North could say, no, we're not going to turn the slave over to you. So when the slave escaped to the North after the Fugitive Slave Act, they were allowed to come and get them. So they were coming and getting them and putting them into prisons. And my great-great-grandfather, Henry Green, and a bunch of other blacks who were free were going around freeing the slaves. As they were putting them in the jails, they would go around and free these slaves. And the slave owner approached Henry Green and a bunch of other free blacks in the community, and he wound up dead. And because of that, the Marines came in and they took over the town and they arrested, you know, the like 38 black males. And they were charged with treason. They were put in prison. And they were tried in Philadelphia. And this was, the murder took place on 9/11/1851. Think about that date. 9/11/1851. That's when the murder took place. And the trial took place like a year or so later. And Thaddeus Stevens, who was in the movie Lincoln, he was their defense attorney. And he got them off. They all were able to walk free. And yet, this is not in the history books. But in my book, Black Maple, The Life and Times of Henry Green, I talk about that. And I talk about who my great-great-grandfather's heroes were, like Frederick Douglass, like these, you know, the abolitionists that were coming into town and talking about, you know, you need to take a stand, you need to help your brothers who are slaves, just because you're free, you know, it doesn't mean you're off the hook. And, you know, the same thing I'm trying to say to the people in the community is that, you know, do something and help, you know, help other people. Don't look back and say, oh, he's not working. Isn't that sad? I'm working. No, what you do is you try to help that brother find a job, you know, because that's going to help you. That's going to help your community. And the other thing that I'm doing is I have a petition for my son. I have I'm helping my son, getting the story out about my son being wrongfully convicted. So he's on Facebook. It's we demand an investigation into the wrongful conviction of Kerry Baxter. So that's on Facebook, and if you go on the Facebook page, the petition is on the page, and we're asking people to sign the petition and to pass it on, and until we get enough signatures so that we can take it up and give it, you know, knock on Kamala Harris's door and present her with this petition. Thank you.
Great. Well, we'll have links to all these events and also the petitions and the information in regards to the actions. So thank you both for coming in and sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you for having us.
Radio Autonomía, Zapatismo in the Bay. This is Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM. Radio Autonomía comes to you the first Sunday of every month from 4 to 6 p.m. To listen to and download past Radio Autonomía segments, including this show with the two interviews we had today, you can visit our website at radioautonomía.wordpress.com. And if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or you want to get involved, shoot us an email at radioautonomía@gmail.com. So thank you for tuning in, and we'll catch you guys next month. Yeah.
This is precisely why we have to do our analysis. We need to become as effective as they have become through their analysis. And this was an analysis given them, 2,500.